Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Today's episode is presented by EIT Raw Materials. EIT Raw Materials is on a mission to develop sustainable raw material supply into a major strength for Europe. Join us at the Raw Materials Summit from May 14th through 16th in Brussels. Find out more at EITRMSummit.com.
We're entering a new and crucial phase in a fight against coronavirus.
Entsprechend unserer Hotspot-Strategie.
Der deuxième vague.
Para hacer frente al coronavirus, al COVID-19.
We have to coordinate these measures to make life easier for Europeans.
Welcome to EU Confidential. I'm Andrew Gray, Politico's EU editor in Brussels. Well, the coronavirus never really went away, but now it's definitely back with a vengeance. Numbers are surging across Europe, and as you just heard, every day European leaders are issuing warnings and announcing new restrictions. We'll look at the state of the fight against the virus across Europe. We'll also ask whether politicians are still following the science and whether another casualty of this pandemic could be the bond of trust between Europeans and their leaders. And be sure to stay tuned to the very end of the show for an extra treat from our podcast panel. That will come after our feature interview with Estonian President Kersti Kaljulaid, who's also a candidate to lead the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. She talks about digital transformation, the rise of the far right, and relations with the US, among other things. But first, let's focus on the coronavirus. I'm joined by our health reporter, Gillian Deutsch. Hi, Gillian.
Hey, Andrew.
Let's just start off with an overview, if we can. I mean, obviously, things are changing by the day. We're recording late Wednesday, so some of the kind of numbers may change between now and when our listeners hear this. But give us a sense of it. You know, there's been talk about a second wave for, well, months. Are we there now? And you know, how does the kind of overall situation, I know it varies across Europe, but the overall situation compare to when things got, you know, really bad in the spring?
Yeah, I mean, whether you call it a second wave or a resurgence in cases, it doesn't necessarily matter. What we definitely see, though, is that things are not looking very good in Europe. We're definitely seeing a whole bunch of countries with higher case numbers than we saw even in the spring. There are scientifically sound reasons for this. Countries are testing much more than they ever used to. We're not seeing hospitalization rates like we used to, and certainly not death numbers like we used to. But I was talking to some experts earlier today who were saying that we definitely will start to see that. What is good, though, is that we do know more about the virus than we used to, which means that we probably don't have to go back to, you know, blanket-wide lockdowns across countries. I mean, I might be eating my words in a month's time, so.
What is it that we kind of do know now that might help us to avoid that?
Well, there's better data. So countries can actually figure out, okay, you know, where are really the hotspots within the country? Are there certain areas that are actually just worse? So we could do maybe a very more localized lockdown in just a city that's really bad, rather than locking down an entire country or banning travel between two countries. We also do know there's increasing evidence that the virus is aerosol, which means that it can transmit in much smaller particles in the air. And this is kind of bad news in the sense that, you know, it can sit in the air much longer, and that increases the chances that it can infect more people. But if we do know that, then we know that we can ventilate areas. We can choose to be outside more frequently, which is obviously more difficult as winter months come. But that does mean that we can adapt measures a bit better than we could in the spring.
So let's zoom in a bit on the EU and, you know, attempts to try and have some kind of uniform approach or coordinated standards across the bloc. What's the state of efforts to do that at the moment? You know, what has the EU been trying to do at kind of institutional level, and how successful have they been?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely have seen an improvement in coordination from the early days of the pandemic when we saw, you know, countries implementing border restrictions against one another and closing their borders. But that doesn't necessarily say much that that's an improvement. For example, you know, the Commission tried to get EU countries on board to agree to harmonize travel restrictions. And so after weeks and weeks and weeks of negotiations between countries, essentially what they agreed to was not really what the Commission had hoped for. In the end, what countries agreed to was that they would create standardized maps. And that would basically just lay out, you know, how many infection rates are per country. But in the end, every country can decide for themselves. So, for example, you know, you might have a country that's designated as an orange zone, but one country can say, okay, we require those people to quarantine for 2 weeks when they arrive here. Another country can say, okay, we require two tests once they get here. Another country can just ban travel altogether from that country.
Right. So there was an attempt to kind of standardize what the rules should be if you're moving from these kind of, an orange zone is kind of somewhere in the middle, a place that's kind of where the numbers are of concern, but not kind of a red zone where, you know, often that means that you're going to face bans or restrictions on travel. But it does sound like there were also some talk, right, of using tests rather than having these quarantine periods, which again are different. Different countries have different measures, right, of those. So there was an attempt, I think, to try and standardize that. How many days should you have to self-isolate? And then is there a way in which that those periods could be shortened by using tests? But there seemed to be some concern from the ECDC itself about using those tests.
It was quite interesting because in talks between the countries and the Commission, where the ECDC was present, the Commission was trying to push tests rather than a mandatory quarantine period. And the ECDC was saying, look, that's not actually scientifically sound because it's hard to detect the virus when there's an incubation period at the very beginning. So that's not really enough.
Interesting. So obviously, as we've said repeatedly on this podcast, and everyone says, it feels like the only kind of permanent way out of this crisis is when there's a vaccine. And I know that's something you've been tracking very closely. So I know this is, you know, we can't answer this definitively, but what's your best sense of how far away we are from a vaccine which might, you know, lead to a way out of this crisis?
I do have some better news there. I mean, I know for every time I've been on this podcast, I think I've talked about how long it takes to develop a vaccine and all the safety and efficacy trials. And we're actually moving quite quickly, though. We have more than 10 vaccines that are in phase 3 clinical trials, which means basically that you're testing those vaccines in really highly endemic areas on tens of thousands of people to really see if it's actually effective. And so we have quite a number of those in that stage and dozens others that are in phase 1 and phase 2 trials. So that's quite promising. We actually could potentially see a situation where we have a vaccine approved by the European Medicines Agency early next year. The problem with that, though, is that even once we get a vaccine approved, we're then going to face major production hurdles. You know, we're not going to be able to roll these out across the globe. So that's going to be difficult. Who gets them first? And then also ensuring that those vaccines are actually given to the right people across the globe.
Yeah, okay. So sometime next year, you know, we should have a vaccine, but that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody's going to get it super quickly. Okay, well, we'll keep checking back in with you and your colleagues from the health team as this, I was going to say progresses. I don't know if that's really the right word, but continues. Gillian, for now, thanks very much.
Thank you very much for having me. And sorry, I don't have more happy news, but I'll report first
one
thing
day,
when I do.
One day,
someday very
one
soon.
One day we'll
hopefully
have a special happy edition.
Yeah.
Now, to talk about the broader political implications of the coronavirus, let's bring in our podcast panel. Reem is in Paris. Hi, Reem.
Hello.
And Matt's in Berlin. Hi, Matt.
Guten Morgen.
Okay, so we actually are talking to you at a very good time because we're recording on Thursday, and just last night, both Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron were talking about the coronavirus and talking about measures to be taken as the number of cases continues to increase. Reem, just want to give us a very brief overview of the kind of headlines from what Macron had to say. And what's the initial reaction been?
Yeah, so on Wednesday night, Macron gave a very long-awaited evening television interview in which he announced that a curfew was going to be imposed in the 9 biggest population urban centers, including the Paris area, but not just. And these centers are actually all across France, which is quite striking. And so there's a curfew that's going to start Saturday. It will be a curfew from 9 p.m. to 6 a.m. It is supposed to last 4 weeks and then can be extended, and the government will ask for its extension until December 1st. And the idea behind it, Macron said, is that obviously in the second wave, the idea is that people have to live with the virus, but they have to continue trying to contain it. And to contain it, these moments, as he called them, these social gathering moments, have to be limited, because it's when the risk is highest, when people are drinking alcohol, when people are socializing with the people they like. And so he also said that there would be a limitation to 6 people in terms of how many people you can have over for dinner, or that you can go out with to a restaurant, as long as you've left by 9 p.m.
Okay, and a slightly different approach in Germany. Of course, you know, Germany has not been hit as hard as a lot of other European countries, Matt, but the numbers are also going up. And it was quite interesting to see the contrast last night, where Emmanuel Macron can just come out. He did this in a TV interview rather than a kind of formal address to the nation this time, but it was still very much the president in charge saying, here's the plan, here are the measures. Angela Merkel, often, you know, probably rightly described as the most powerful person in Europe, can't actually do that, right? She was haggling with the state premiers last night. And where did they get to?
Well, you have to wonder how powerful she really is if she can't even get a curfew. Although I don't think that she was really looking for a curfew. She was looking for somewhat stricter measures than they agreed in the end. And the problem in Germany is that all of these things become a negotiation between the government and the federal states. At the end of the meeting, they came up with something of a compromise, which is, you know, more or less that most of the states are still going to do whatever they want to do. So you have a kind of patchwork now where, for example, some states have imposed a lodging ban on people who live in other parts of the country where they have exceeded, you know, a certain number of cases per 100,000. So Berlin, for example, is considered to be a red zone. So people from Berlin cannot go to the neighboring state of Brandenburg on vacation now and stay in a bed and breakfast or something like that without...
Matt, I'm very confused by this, because how can people know where you're coming from? I mean, is it on your, like, ID?
Well, I think in most cases they see your license plate, number one. But you also have to register at a hotel. If you stay in a hotel or a bed and breakfast, you have to, you know, fill out a form saying where your residence is. And if you get caught, the fines can be quite high. So there's a disincentive to even try to go somewhere. And I think most people won't go to the bother of getting a test, because getting a test is easy, but it's still a pain, and you have to wait a few days to get the results of the test. So the long and short of it is that fewer people are going to be going on vacation now, and now is the time that a lot of schools in Berlin, for example, have this fall break. You know, that said, the number of cases across Germany are going up quite dramatically, as Merkel warned, and as I was poo-pooing last week. We're now at over 6,000. So yeah, we'll see.
Don't mess with Merkel, Matt. You should know that by now.
Is this a moment of Matt eating crow? I can't believe it.
Oh, no. I will be.
There must be some kind of technical
right
problem. Yeah. But maybe we've got an AI Matt this week, and it's not quite, you know, they haven't quite perfected the programming yet. But I think that conversation raises a really interesting point, which is about enforceability. And some of these measures, they do rely a lot on trust between businesses and government, between people in the government. Here in Brussels, we don't have a full curfew yet, but we do have a situation where the bars and the cafes are meant to be closed, but restaurants are allowed to stay open. Now, that allows a lot of cafes and bars to say, actually, we're a restaurant, we serve food, we're going to serve food, and they continue to stay open, which, you know, they may just be about within their rights to do, but it sounds to me like defeats the purpose of this, which is to stop people, you know, congregating for extended periods indoors. But I do think, obviously, for a lot of these businesses that have already undergone a lot of hardship this year and had to shut down once, you know, they're going to do everything possible they can to avoid this. So I just wonder, you know, are we getting to a point where that kind of link between the governed and those governing kind of breaks down, or is in danger of breaking down, because people either don't trust the politicians to have dealt with this properly, given it's now the second time around and we still seem to be scrambling for ideas, or also that they're just not going to obey them because for them it's becoming existential and then, you know, they're just not going to go along with what they're being told to do. I mean, how much of a noise are you hearing, if you like, Reem, from people saying we're not going to go along with this, or this is unreasonable and, you know, we don't want to do it?
Well, you know, there is that cliche of the French being kind of not very good at following instructions and kind of respecting basically laws. But the reality is, and this is something that I think the government is having a hard time also owning up to, they themselves didn't want to impose very drastic measures during the summer because they were afraid and they knew that if they did, then the French would like revolt completely. So it's kind of a chicken and egg situation where the government is afraid of the rebellion, and so they don't really impose all the measures they think they should be imposing. And then the people are also just like, these measures make no sense. For example, on Wednesday night, when Macron announced the curfew, there were many people who were saying, if it's this important, why not start the curfew immediately on Wednesday night? Why wait until Saturday? Also, at the beginning of the crisis, we saw Macron in particular constantly say that he's being guided by the science. That whole language has disappeared from his kind of public pronouncements on it. He still says, you know, we're listening to what the doctors are learning. It's a learning curve. But that famed scientific council that it was set up at the beginning of the crisis and that had met multiple times with Macron at the height of the crisis no longer meets with him as often. And in fact, its last recommendation was submitted at the end of September. So at least 3 weeks ago, before they decided to put in place this curfew.
Right. And that does seem to be a trend. You know, we've seen in both the UK and Ireland, just to name two, you know, cases where the scientists asked for very specific measures and ultimately the government decided to go a different way. Now, in a sense, of course, that's what politicians are for, right? They weigh up different risks. They take advice from different groups. But at least the rhetoric has changed a lot from the constant we're being guided by the science. And a lot of these scientists having very, very high profiles, right, becoming extremely well known. I mean, some of them still are. I mean, in Germany, I think there was a kind of, you know, almost a celebrity. I don't know if he was an epidemiologist, Matt, right, with his own podcast. And as we know, you don't get more celebrity than that.
Christian Drosten.
Yeah, right. So how is it in Germany? And do you think that is, first of all, that, you know, that politicians are gradually kind of moving away from this, you know, we follow the science mantra as things go on?
Well, I think there's definitely a push and pull here. And I do have a sense that people are getting a bit tired of some of the harsher measures, even though Germany hasn't really faced the kinds of restrictions that we've seen in France and Belgium. I also would say, though, that as long as the government steps into the breach and continues to, you know, see to it that people get their salaries one way or another and that businesses stay afloat, that it's easier for people to cope. And that is starting to change now, though, that I've noticed, you know, more stores and restaurants in particular going out of business. One of my favorite places, in fact, a little French place called the Brasserie this week.
This podcast is full of surprises this week. Wow.
This podcast is just throwing us off completely.
It's just like bombshell after bombshell. One of your favorite places is French.
You know, but I think, you know, the strange thing here is not just the kind of patchwork, as I said, in Germany, but across Europe. So, for example, in Berlin, they announced that all bars have to stop serving alcohol at 11 p.m. So apparently this is the first time this has happened since World War II. So that would seem to be quite dramatic. Although I don't know if you have any, you know, greater chance of getting COVID after 11 p.m. than before 11 p.m.
Right.
So there are things like this that are not really, you know, clear.
So that question has been raised about, like, really, does COVID just sort of take a break during the day and then come back to work at night? And the response is, no, at night you tend to drink more alcohol and so you're less inhibited. And so then you start touching people more and giving each other COVID.
Well, speak for yourself.
Right. Well, that seems
speak
to
for
be
yourself, right?
Yeah. this is it. Well, again, could be a French thing. Probably not something Matt does too much.
Probably a French thing.
But this is it. So in a sense, that's certainly, if you look across Europe, you can see that there's, you know, the different countries, different people behave differently. You can understand why there's a kind of difference in measures. But then there seem to be others where it's not very clear. It's not very clear in the first place why they have chosen, for example, here in Brussels, to say, okay, cafes have to close, but restaurants can stay open. I happen to know in Scotland, it's the other way around. They've said, keep the cafes open, particularly for people, you know, living on their own. It gets them out during the day. But, you know, we want to avoid also the sale of alcohol in a lot of cases. So, again, I wonder if it just adds to this sense and this danger of a loss of trust, you know, in authority, that there doesn't seem to be a very clear idea where you can look across Europe and say, well, everybody's doing pretty much the same thing and they're doing it because it's very clear logic behind it. A lot of it just feels a little bit like people are scrambling literally day to day or week to week to come up with whatever measure they think might work. I mean, for a while here in Brussels, we had to wear masks anywhere outdoors, including in, you know, deserted streets. Now, the numbers are now worse than when that was happening, but we don't have that restriction anymore.
Well, and in Sweden, they're still not wearing masks, right?
Right, yeah.
And here's the other thing. I think the argument of we're still discovering this virus and we're still trying to figure out day to day how to deal with it, I think was audible in March and was audible in June. It is much less audible in October. I mean, you must have a way to kind of deal with it in a less haphazard way.
I think that's the real danger, yeah, that there's a lot less understanding for
a
that
lot less.
For people now saying, hold on, you had all summer to figure this out. We knew this was coming back.
And people are fed up.
Well, that's the point, is that everybody knew it was coming back, right? I mean, every pandemic has a second wave in the fall, and I don't think this should be surprising to anybody that we're facing this situation now.
So that actually, let's leave it there for now. Matt and Reem are going to come back later for something we're going to do at the very end of the podcast, where as we face the prospect of having to entertain ourselves more and more as we're not allowed to go out and have fun, I've asked each of them to recommend something that people might want to read or watch or listen to, and I'll have one as well, but we'll do that at the end of the podcast. So Reem, Matt, thanks very much for now.
Thank you.
Bye.
Now it's time for our feature interview with Estonian President Kersti Kaljulaid. Our own David Herzenhorn sat down with her for a socially distanced chat when she was in Brussels last week. As you probably know, Estonia takes great pride in being a very digitally advanced society, and that idea is central to the President's pitch to be the next Secretary General of the OECD. That's the organisation that brings together 37 of the world's leading economies and is at the centre of a number of big debates right now, including on digital tax. Kaljulaid sets out her case at the start of the interview.
I see behind the first curve of digitalization precisely because I'm an Estonian. I was there 20 years ago advising Prime Minister of Estonia when we started the digital transformation. And we thought we'll be maybe 2-3 years ahead of the big European nations, and we thought we'll get our digital government cheaper if we go quickly. Instead of this, 20 years later, we are still the only one who has taken the first curve and see behind the bend what is to come. We are the only digitally transformed nation. So we probably know a little bit more about how societies are transforming because of the technology. That is an advantage, I believe, what we have.
Something that's been big in the news as you talk about global taxation, you talk about wanting to still be a part of a national social security system. Mm-hmm. But aren't we headed to some level where if there isn't global cooperation, mm-hmm. nobody's mm-hmm. systems necessarily work?
I mean, exactly. We are losing the taxpayers because our system doesn't fit them. Never mind how you earn your income, where you earn your income globally. You must be able to have an agreement with a state that this state is your safe dock and you have all the transparent and easy means and ways to pay taxes where you choose to. We encourage people to, work EU-wide. We should support also this encouragement with services. We do. In Estonia, of course, you have e-elections and you can change your driver's license and renew it online and so on. So to a certain extent, we know that it's also possible to follow your citizen with your services. But doesn't it take a little bit more of global thinking, of making sure, for example, that healthcare systems really work borderless?
Talk to us a little bit about one of the biggest issues that has been in the arena of the OECD, which is the question of can there be a digital tax mm-hmm. that's agreed upon by Washington as much as Brussels and the EU. Do you have thoughts on how do you convince everyone that somehow this has to happen?
I think we need to take much wider picture on how digital changes, because right now, indeed, as soon as we start talking about digital economy and what impact it has on our taxation, everybody's thinking of taxing multinationals. I agree, this needs to be resolved. The system has to be relatively simple. It has to be worth having in this sense that the proportion of income which will be taxed by the countries where the service or goods have been offered, I mean, needs to be considerable, so that, I mean, it's worth the hustle.
And it's really, in a way, depressing, isn't it, that with all the technology we have, when the lockdowns happened, we couldn't get online education working.
We could.
Very fast. But we could have, perhaps. But it didn't happen, right, in many places.
Many people ask that, tell us how the Estonia, how in the digital Estonia then the world changed. And the answer is actually indeed that, I mean, in online education there was obviously a huge upscaling. But I mean, already the schools had a system, the e-school system, where students, teachers, parents regularly interacted. In our e-health system, I mean, the only change we needed to do was this, that previously in e-health system it was the doctor who started your sick leave. And we decided that in the emergency, like a virus, people are allowed to start their own sick leave. So you were given authorization to access e-health system, not only to check whether you are on sick leave, but also to put yourself on sick leave. Your doctor was notified. They verified, checked the symptoms. Sure, somebody free rode. But, I mean, this was less of a cost, less of a risk than having all people running to the doctor because they have symptoms.
What do you say to the people who say, but Estonia is so small. Sure, you can do that in Estonia, but try doing that in Russia or in China.
The wonderful thing about the internet is that it is massively easily upscalable and geography neutral. Now, it's not smallness. It's that you don't understand the risks. But that is not true. We understand the risks, and our digital environment is much stronger regulated than is any GDPR, for example.
So are you convinced then that a big country, whether it's India or the United States, can do e-elections?
You never start with e-elections. This is a high-trust, high-level service. All your people have to be rather exercised in cyber hygiene and trust the system. You don't build separate e-health or e-voting system. You build an e-ecosystem which is accessible only with digital ID. Then you train people to use this system with low-risk services like school registrations, for example, social services, because, I mean, applying for social support so that your neighbor doesn't see you in the office and queuing there. Very good thing. I mean, really incites people to come on board. And then you gradually move on to high-risk trick, involve private sector, so that they use the same digital ID, because people don't communicate with government often enough to, I mean, naturalize this system in their minds. So e-voting is the final level service, and nobody should start from creating, I mean, first service electronic voting. Tax board is a really good one, you know. Nobody wants to see the taxman. I'm not joking. This was our first.
Right. We have little time, so let's ask you about security, because as you said, you know these issues well, especially being in Estonia. You had meetings also at NATO. The situation with Alexei Navalny, the continuing situation with a threat from Russia, plus now quite close by the upheaval in Belarus. Start wherever you like on all of these things.
Well, on Navalny, it's very simple. People for some reason say that what happened to Navalny is not the same as what happened to Skripal, because that was a chemical weapon level attack on the NATO territory. And I say, no, exactly, this wasn't the same, but it's exactly the same what happened in Syria. Only there it happened to more people than in Russia. But in fact, the infringement of international law is exactly the same. In Belarus is an interesting case, because, I mean, of course, let's say the other side likes to, I mean, make the situation seem like this, that, I mean, European countries are trying to enlarge their sphere of influence involving Belarus. But this is not the case. Belarusian people want the right to decide democratically for their own country's future. And this is what we stand by, and this is what we support. We are not vying for influence. No way.
Right. We have seen, maybe alarming for some people, knowing Estonia's openness, a far-right streak appear in recent years. This is not alone in Germany and in other places as well. But how do you account for what's happened? What are people reacting to?
We talked lengthily about how our systems have failed middle class and lower middle classes. Same in Estonia. I mean, in the 90s, when Estonia started economic transformation, we didn't have resources to kind of counter for the side effects, which is, I mean, depletion of population in rural areas because people were for productivity gathering into the towns. Then, to a certain extent, well, because you see your GDP per capita is growing very fast, you think everybody, I mean, tide rises every ship, as the saying goes. But you have to forcefully take care that people don't feel left behind. The best way of doing it in the countries where you don't have egalitarian education system is to go for it. In Estonia, we do have it. We also have very good universal healthcare. But even in Estonia, this, I mean, if you take Tallinn out of Estonia and calculate GDP per capita, it's 55% of the EU average. Tallinn is 135. With this kind of decalage, for those people who have not gained from all this development, and this is now not only Estonia, this is a universal concept, they want to look for, I mean, basically changing radically the system, hoping that the new distribution of wealth will be more forthcoming for them. And this gives us this streak, I'm afraid.
So you see, income inequality is a driver
quite
of this.
Yeah.
Quickly, I should ask you before we ask about the
not
the
even
three
income
C's.
Inequality, but feeling that you do not have access to the services of the government as well. I mean, because if roads are bad and services are far, you don't get them. I think income inequality people can tolerate as far as there is good education, good healthcare, and good access to public service.
Thank you so much. There's a U.S. election in November. Do you worry about four more years of Donald Trump?
Interestingly, no.
In NATO, for example, specifically.
I mean, it's only worth worrying about things which depend on you. I mean, it's American people who choose their president democratically. We don't dispute about that. I mean, we work with whoever there is in White House. And by the way, our contacts with White House have not been bad. If you look what has been going on in the region of Baltics and Poland, I mean, considering defense issues, then you have nothing to complain. And finally, I'm really sorry, but I mean, European countries should be spending the 2% they agreed in 2014. And everybody has been telling this in a nicer format. And shame on us that it took somebody with a not so nice format to say us that we need to defend ourselves. And there is a geopolitical reason for that. Russia used to be a global risk. Now that is China. Russia is a regional risk and Europe should manage its regional risk themselves. So never mind who is the president. It's fine.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so thanks to David for bringing us that conversation with the Estonian president. And now, as promised, Matt and Reem are back to give us a recommendation. This is something we're going to try and do at the end of the podcast every week. So, Reem, let's start with you. What's your recommendation?
This week, really, my recommendation is an article by Ben Smith, who is the New York Times sort of media columnist. And this week, on Monday, he had to write a piece about his own paper, the New York Times, and a scandal that has erupted. The central character of the award-winning New York Times podcast, Caliphate, is now under fire because he's been arrested in Canada, his home country, on accusations of having made up most of his story related to his time in ISIS. And the issue that has come up with the reporting of this podcast is that these issues on the credibility of this sort of star witness or character had come up way before the podcast was put together, and yet the New York Times sort of went ahead with it. But it also raised other bigger questions about the reporting of this sort of reporter, Rukmini Kalamashi, and Ben Smith had to write that piece, which is never easy. It's never easy to write or investigate your own employer or your own colleagues. And I think he does a marvelous job sort of wading through that minefield. So the headline of the article is "An Arrest in Canada Casts a Shadow on a New York Times Star and the Times."
Right. And we'll include a link in the notes that go along with this podcast. Matt, what's your recommendation?
Yeah. So, my choice is something a little bit on the lighter side in these dark days that we're facing. I stumbled upon this show, I guess we would call it a sitcom, on Netflix called Emily in Paris, which reminded me...
Oh, the
reminded
terror.
Me of another young American woman who shall remain anonymous who lives in Paris. And it's a funny show about you know Americans coming to Europe and some of the challenges they face in dealing with the natives.
Are you saying this is like an exercise in hyper realism, Matt? Because that's not the sense I get from other reviews.
Yeah, I think it gets a bum rap in other reviews. It's a fun show, and you know people shouldn't take it too seriously, especially if you're French.
Okay, good. Well, there we go.
Well, I have to say, yeah, the French have had a completely bad reaction to it. They think that it's just completely wrong and full of cliches, but. That's probably why.
Which is all the more reason to watch it.
There we go. Well, everyone can.
Got to see it.
These are recommendations. Everyone can watch and make their own judgments on the article on Emily in Paris. And I will throw one into the mix, which is actually something that Reem and others recommended a while ago. Also has a French connection, but perhaps of slightly higher quality. It's Le Bureau des Légendes. It's a spy series set in a part of the French Secret Service that looks after undercover agents. It's been going for a few years in France, right? I think they've done five seasons, if I'm right. So the good thing is, I've just got through the first season. Very good. I think it has touches of Le Carré, has touches of some of the best American drama at its height. You know, things even like The Wire, you know, it reminded me of a little bit. It's very well written, very well acted. And the great thing is, as I say, it has five seasons. So if we are heading back into lockdown, there are a lot of episodes to keep us going through what could be a long winter. So those are my tips, and those are Reem's and Matt's. And that will do it for this week. So Reem, Matt, thanks again very much.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have on this episode of EU Confidential. Please take a moment to click subscribe or follow wherever you listen to the podcast so you never miss an episode. And if you like the podcast, we'd appreciate you clicking some stars or even leaving a short review. You can also send us feedback. Maybe you have some recommendations of your own for us or for our listeners. The email address is podcast@politico.eu. Have at it, as they say in the US. And talking of the US, Ryan Heath is back on Tuesday with another episode of Campaign Confidential. And we'll be back next Thursday with another EU Confidential. I'm Andrew Gray in Brussels. Thanks to our producer, Christina Gonzalez, and thanks to you for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.